Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the second talk which I've going to give in the Lanes Retreat. The last talk I gave just over a week ago was about some of the things which help give rise to the achievement of jhanas, and I wanted this evening to go into more detail about the experience of jhanas again, because this Lanes Retreat here has the opportunity, the facilities, the support, the weather, which would really help one attain to these states. And I know that even speaking about these things will motivate and inspire a person to put forth the effort in the correct direction, so that maybe the mind will incline towards that which we call jhana, and even enter them and abide therein, thereby experiencing the pleasure of jhanas, and realizing that those states which were talked about in the time of the Buddha, which are mentioned in the suttas, are accessible to people today, and that the Dharma of the Buddha is not just something you read in books, but something which you can experience, not just part of that Dharma, but all of the Dharma which the Buddha taught, one can experience for oneself. And that makes the Dharma come alive. It gives rise to increased faith, increased commitment to take this practice even further, eventually to its summit of Magapala, of the Arahat. And indeed, as bhikkhus, as anagarikas staying here, that has to be our goal, just the summit. The goal, as it said in the suttas, for which a young man of good family go forth in order to attain the summit of the practice, the end of dukkha, the eradication of all the asavas, the attainment of the goal, liberation, nibbana. And of course, everyone here should know by now that the practice of jhanas is an important part of that gradual progress towards the summit. And I say categorically that it's an essential part of the path towards Arahat, and that you cannot achieve the final goal without the achievement of Arahat, without the achievement of jhanas. And so it does make it quite clear and quite plain that these things are an important part. And indeed, why not? People in the time of the Buddha, even lay people, would achieve these states. And so why can't we? One of the reasons why we can't, first of all, is because it's not encouraged. It's not talked about in many monasteries. And we think that because no one talks about it, it's impossible for us. But perhaps even more so, in a place like this where it is talked about, where it is encouraged, it is because that these states we call jhanas are very subtle states of mind. And for people who are born in the West, whose attention is very much concerned with the outside world, and we know the outside world of materiality very well, to know the world of the mind is sometimes very difficult. We're dealing with subtle states here. In particular with jhanas, you're dealing with things we call nimittas. And here the meaning of this word in terms of the practice of jhana is mental states, mental perceptions, which can be very subtle, very hard to describe. And it's these mental states, these mental nimittas, these mental signs or signposts, features of the landscape of jhana, which do become difficult to describe, and therefore can be quite misleading. And so I would like to, in this talk, to explain something about, you know, what these signs are in a jhana. But of course one really should go back a little bit earlier in the progress and how to achieve these states. I was saying to someone yesterday, it's a quote by another monk whose name I cannot remember because it's so long ago, who once told a person who was having difficulty concentrating the mind. In brief, he said, the reason is that you're having trouble concentrating the mind and getting the mind peaceful is because you're attached to the world. And it was a very, one of these pithy statements which was extremely accurate and which one can always reflect upon and to find out if that's really what's blocking you from attaining to these states. And we were talking about the world here, that monk perhaps wasn't so precise what he should have really said, was being attached to the world of the five senses, that which we call karma loka, because it's that world of the five senses where most people seek their delight, seek their pleasure, seek their satisfaction. And that world of the five senses is diametrically opposed to the world of jhanas. And if a person delights in the world of those five senses, if they seek satisfaction there, if they do most of their business there, if they are caught up with trying to control that world, manipulate it, change it, worrying about it, thinking about it, then it's going to be a great obstacle to the attainment of that which we call jhanas. The attachment to the things outside is what stops us dwelling on that secure, stable inner place which we call the achievement of jhanas. And so, in brief, the greatest obstacle to the attainment of jhanas is the attachment to the outer world. And that's why that when the Buddha described jhanas, he started to talk about being secluded. And first of all, that seclusion is the kaya viveka, and the seclusion of the body. And that kaya viveka, the seclusion of the body, means by drawing the body away from those external situations, those external lifestyles, which do inhibit the achievement of jhanas, which get one caught up with things. It comes to mind the story of the Buddha staying in a forest with many very good monks, and many people came to that monastery one day. I don't know if it was somebody's birthday that day or what. I'm just saying that just for the sake of the table. It was my birthday yesterday, and we got a lot of people in the monastery, and it was certainly an obstacle to my meditation yesterday. And when many people came to that monastery to visit the Buddha, the many other monks in that monastery, they just got their bowl and robes and just left. And these were monks who didn't have a kuti full of things, they just had a bowl and robes, they just took those things and they went to another forest nearby. And they reasoned that, like noise, they said, is like a thorn to samadhi, especially it's a thorn to the attainment of first jhana. And when one realizes that, you can start to understand why we have like kaya viveka, taking the body, you know, this bodily frame of ours, away from these great disturbances, especially the disturbance of noise, into a forest, into a place where there's very little to look at and see. I remember one monk in Thailand once saying that forests are some of the best places to develop jhanas, or maybe caves, but the trouble with mountains is that there's so much to see on top of a mountain, you have great views. Or the trouble with a monastery by the ocean is again that the ocean can just attract you outside. With a forest, especially in a dense forest like the forests of Thailand or the jungles of Asia, you know, once you're staying in a forest, there's not much to look at. Just after a while one tree looks the same as another. You cannot see very far outside, and what you see is all the same, it doesn't change, it doesn't move. And that means that instead of the senses going outside, it does really help keep the senses pointed inside. And this really perhaps is the job of Kaya Viveka. It means there's less to draw the less to draw the senses outside of you, which gives you more opportunity to have the senses go within, or get the attention go within rather. And so that Kaya Viveka is extremely important. Then in a monastery like this, there's great opportunity for Kaya Viveka, but just coming to a monastery is not sufficient. It's how one uses the facilities we have here. Now, how much one develops that sense of seclusion, the sense of somebody who just comes around without saying anything to anyone and leaves again, almost so the other monks don't know you're in the monastery. Now, that invisible monk ideal becomes, you know, the thing to aim for if one wishes to get Kaya Viveka, this bodily seclusion. You know, a person comes to a meal, you know, they do what they need to do, they know all the routine, they just do their job, wash their bowl and go back afterwards, and no one sees them, they don't speak to anybody. And there's someone who can really practice Kaya Viveka in a forest. Other monks who go around talking to one another, making a noise, laughing, joking, talking to lay people, looking for people to talk to, these are the ones who they may be living in a forest but they don't know Kaya Viveka. Then they'll find that a great obstacle to the attainment of jhanas. So one has to, at least from the very beginning, to develop that Kaya Viveka which takes one away from external stimulation. And again, this forest is a marvelous opportunity to develop this. No one really needs to talk to lay people, only me. And so that you can just disappear and go back. And in fact, you will find, and lay people have told me this, it's the monks who don't talk to them, the ones they respect, not the ones who chat and joke and laugh. They appreciate what a monk should be doing here, and they wish to support that ideal. So don't think that you have to go around talking, chatting and entertaining the lay people. I mean, that is my job. That's the one I've taken on as the senior monk here. But just doing Kaya Viveka is certainly not enough for jhanas. We have to also develop the Citta Viveka. And Citta Viveka is developing jhanas. I think I remember in one sutta somewhere that the happiness, the joy of jhana, of first jhana, sorry, is called Paviveka Sukha. The happiness of seclusion. And indeed, if you go towards the Buddha's standard explanation of first jhana, which goes vivicchehi kamehi vivicha akusalehi dhammehi. And for those of you who don't know Pali, vivicha is, it comes from the verb. It's like having vivekad, to use like an anglicized Pali expression, having become seclusion. Whereas viveka is the noun. And it's just a different parts of speech, nothing more. But it is really basically the same word. And it really gives the indication of what citta viveka means. The citta viveka means having been secluded from what? Secluded from karma. This is the K long A-M-A, the sensuality, the seeking delights in the world of the five senses, the concern with that world, the involvement with that world, secluded from all of that, having let go of all of that, having given up all of that, and secluded from akusala dhammas, unwholesome dhammas. And this is what one is giving up, being secluded from. And another way of putting that, the way it's explained in the texts, in the commentaries, is that being secluded from karma is being secluded from karma chanda, being the first of the five hindrances. and being secluded from akusala dhammas is referring to the other four hindrances. So what one is really being secluded from is just these five hindrances, which all of you should know are karma chanda, being the involvement with the sensory world. And again, that word chanda has many different meanings, or one meaning but different sort of different emphasis. In the Vinaya, which I know very well, that chanda is what you do if you can't come to a meeting, and you send someone else there to say, please go ahead in my absence. It's more like a consent to go ahead. That part of will, that part of almost like a desire, which says go ahead. But in this particular case, that aspect of chanda really illuminates its meaning in reference to the first of the hindrances. Now the will, or the desire, the allowance, the consent for chanda to go ahead. So the consent for karma to go ahead, for the involvement in sensuality to go ahead. To do all the business concerned with the five senses. And of course that's what we have to become secluded from, that's what we have to give up, that's what we have to abandon if we really wish to enter a jhana. And the other five hindrances, the last four, you should know, avyapada, which is ill will, tinamida, sloth and torpor, that sort of that laxness, that laziness of the body and the mind, the udacha kukacha, that restlessness, and the worry, restlessness being the mind which will not stand still but which keeps on moving backwards and forwards, and its twin, if you like, kukacha, which is usually the restlessness which is dependent upon some lapse in one's sila, some fault in one's virtue, something which is worrying you about something you've said, done, or even thought. This is the restlessness and worry. And the last of the hindrances is doubt, not really knowing. And it's the doubt which keeps on arising, again as a form of restlessness. Should I do this? Should I do that? Is this jhana? Is this not jhana? Is this piti or is this sukha? This is that sort of that doubting mind which is always throwing questions up into the mind and thereby disturbing it. And it's only when we're secluded from these things, abandon these things, that we have a chance to enter a jhana. And so the first part of jhana practice is like finding a way, finding a means to overcome these five hindrances. And you can see that if one hasn't encouraged these five hindrances throughout the day, throughout the week, throughout the month, throughout the year which has been preceding, then there will be weak when you start to sit cross-legged. But if just beforehand one has been developing these things, getting into angry moods with the people you live with, or with yourself, or if you've been getting greed with food or other things in the monastery, or with getting delights in beautiful women who might come to serve food, or getting into fantasies. If one hasn't developed energy during the day, but one has slept in and developed instead laziness, the sloth and torpor, and if one has been encouraging restlessness always by going and doing things rather than just sitting still and doing your meditation, and if one has just let doubt arise in the mind rather than coming to ask some of the senior monks about what the teaching actually is and what the Buddha actually says about such things. If you develop those five hindrances through the day, then they're going to come up when you sit meditation. So one of the first things to remember about the five hindrances is that they're not just overcome after you sit cross-legged. Very often in monastic life, they're overcome throughout the day. But having done what the best one can to overcome the five hindrances at all times of the day, when it comes down to sitting meditation and crossing your legs, then again, to be able to overcome those five hindrances, it's very, very helpful. In fact, it's essential to make sure that the mind puts its attention in the present moment. It becomes a very skillful means, a very effective way of cutting those five hindrances, because many of those five hindrances, they cannot survive if the mind is firmly pointed in that which we call the present moment. And most of those five hindrances, their job is to take you away from that which we call now. And so just bringing the attention to the present moment, bringing the attention to now, what's going on now, I have found in practice to be one of the first things which I do when I sit meditation. And it's one of the most effective preliminaries to start concentrating the attention in the present, to bring in all of the awareness from the things outside. And you can imagine, like for me during this range retreat, that is essential, because there's so many other bits and pieces, duties and responsibilities which I have to carry through for this range retreat. And if I didn't have the ability to do that, there'd be no way that I could get any meditation done, because there's no way, like as a senior monk in this monastery, that you can get everything out of the way and finish everything first of all before you start doing meditation. There's always new things keep coming up, new problems, new telephone calls from people concerning the Buddhist society outside, which unfortunately sort of still intrudes on this retreat for me. But I do very clearly remember a time a couple of years ago spending the weekend in Nolamara, because Ajahn Jakwa was away, I think in Thailand for about 4 or 5 weeks. And it was one of those weekends which was not just busy, but it seemed that whatever one did, that just nothing got solved. Just the jobs to be done, the problems to be sorted out, just kept on multiplying and just getting out of hand and getting worse. Then when I came back here on a Sunday evening, just really tired, I found out that a couple of monks had an argument in the monastery as well, and there was more problems to solve. And that evening, there was a meeting, and I remember just sitting here in this hall at 7 o'clock, just really tired, I don't know if I'd even showered, didn't have really time, and just beginning the meditation, just thinking about, what am I going to do about these monks? What am I going to do about this problem in the Buddhist society? What am I going to do about this? And just realizing, just after, I waited a good 35 minutes, I think, and just realizing that, hang on, you don't need to do all of this during the meditation time. And you know, it is possible, it is good. You can do it, why not do it? So you do it. Just all of the unfinished business to drop and just come into the present moment. Now is the meditation time. Now I didn't need to do anything else. When I sit meditation, when I close my eyes, I'm not the senior monk anymore. I'm not the acting abbot. I'm not a Mahatera, I'm not a Tera, I'm not a new monk, I'm not an Anagarika. I have no responsibilities at all when I close my eyes and start sitting meditation. And it's very important for each one of us to develop that ability just to drop the business of our lives. You will never get everything out of the way, so you have to just leave it undone and just forget about it. And developing that ability to come into the present moment helps enormously to be able to achieve that letting go of one's business, letting go of one's duties, letting go of one's responsibilities. You may all remember that story in the Dhammapada of, again, I forget what the monk's name was, who used to sweep the vihara in the early morning, in the late morning, afternoon and evening. Then the vihara was spotless. And then one of the monks staying in that vihara was one of the arahats. I think it might have been Mahakotita, but I could be wrong there. And he took that monk aside and said that he admired and praised the monk's energy, but the purpose of monastic life is not to keep viharas spotless. The purpose of monastic life is to attain Magampara, to become arahat. So he told the monk to sweep early in the morning and sweep late in the afternoon, but during the rest of the day to practice meditation. And he taught him how to meditate. And as they say in the suttas, in a short time, that monk became fully enlightened, an arahat. As a result, the vihara was no longer spotless and is actually quite shabby. And I don't know, I think maybe lay people might have complained about it. But Mahakotita would say that it's much better to have an arahat in the vihara and have it shabby than to have a spotless vihara and just putuchanas, just ordinary monks. And indeed, that the business which one has in one's life is best to sometimes drop it, leave it alone, and to do that which we really came here to do, to develop our minds, to gain jhana, to gain magapala. So to be able to do this, we have to develop this ability to stay in the present moment and to drop all of our duties and responsibilities. And you may know that dropping your duties and responsibilities is very much karma, kamehi vivicha, having abandoned that world of the five senses, which most of my responsibilities dwell in, live in. It's all the world out there what I'm really responsible for. And so you drop all of that, leave it alone. And when you drop all of that and leave it alone, you start dwelling in the present moment. And when one dwells in the present moment, one starts to have a mind which can very easily turn to something like the breathing. If you don't develop that present moment awareness first of all, then you find that the breath is very hard to find, or the mind isn't sort of able. Perhaps you might say that dwelling in the present moment, letting go of your responsibilities, is another way of like turning the mind to that which we call the happiness of ease. The happiness of having no problems. You know, the happiness of not having to deal with so many things. It's like the happiness of a person going on a holiday, getting away from it all. And again, what are you getting away from? You're getting away from the world of the five senses. And so once one develops dwelling in the present moment, it does bring about this sense of ease in the mind. And that sense of ease in the mind, that sort of happy abiding at this particular level, is that type of sukha which gives rise to samadhi, which makes it possible, which makes it easy. It does need to be mentioned again and again that in the suttas the Buddha said that it is sukha, that happy ease, which is the proximate cause of samadhi. And one of the phrases he used was sukhino chittang samadhiyati. The mind of the happy one becomes concentrated. And so it's not the happiness of ha ha ha, joking around, having a good time, but the happiness of like comfort, of ease, being fulfilled, being satisfied. And how can one get fulfilled and satisfied? You have to get things out of the way. Get all those things which are blocking your fulfillment out of the way. Is that what one needs to do? No. Just don't worry about all those things. That's the only way one will experience that ease. So one dwells in that present moment, person feels like the ease and the space and the openness of just being present with nothing to do. And from that ease, one can just avert the mind, first of all, to the feeling of the breath. And when I say to avert the mind to the feeling of the breath, here in this particular way that I divert a little bit from other teachers, because from my experience it doesn't really matter where you watch the breath. Just to be aware of the sensation of breathing enough to know, first of all, whether you're breathing in or breathing out, to know which one it is, where that particular feeling arises, whether it's at the tip of the nose, the bridge of the nose, in the throat, in the stomach, or elsewhere. It really doesn't matter from my experience. The first thing is just to know. To know whether it's an in-breath, to know whether it's an out-breath. But continually knowing. Because it's the need to sustain this awareness. Not just to have it arise for a moment or two, like for 30 seconds, and then lose it. But to be able to sustain it for a long period, so you know every breath, in-breath, out-breath, the next in-breath, the next out-breath, the next in-breath, the next out-breath, again and again and again and again and again. And just doing this much is helping the mind become still. It's restraining the mind from going off. It's only got little gaps between in-breath and the next out-breath to be able to do something, to go somewhere, and that's really not enough. And so what happens is the awareness tends to stay with the breath rather than going elsewhere. And when one looks, puts one's attention on the feeling this much, then the mind starts to stay with the breath. Then this next stage will be to be able to notice the whole breath. And again, it's just noticing the whole breath in the present moment. Just like one watches a pendulum swing from the left to the right. And you see it from the very beginning of the swing at the left. And you follow it every moment to the right. And there's not one part of that arc which you miss noticing. Just the mindfulness follows it all from the very beginning to its very end. But all the time, all it's knowing is the breath as it's happening now. All the time, that's the only thing in the mind, just feeling of the breath as it's happening now, enough to tell you where it is in the cycle. And at this stage that one has to sustain this awareness, just watching the breath and nothing else, only in the present moment, nowhere else at all. Of course, that the mind will like to go off elsewhere, and quite often at this stage the mind will move away from that sensation. And it is the job of your resolution, determination, will to keep pushing it back onto that object. And if it moves away again, you've got to push it back again. Pushing it back again is that which we call vitakka. It's that mind moving its attention onto the object. The mind sustaining the attention on there is what we call vichara. So just, if one get that very clearly, sort of in one's understanding, the vitakka is like the moving of the mind onto the object, and the vichara is holding it there. Of course, that vitakka and vichara is very much sort of supported and fueled, you know, by the iddhipadas, the channa samadhi, the sustaining of that will to do. You know, this is one's goal, one's aspiration. Is at this stage, it's not to enter jhanas. The goal at this particular stage is to watch the complete breath. So you make that goal clear in your mind, and you sustain that goal until you achieve it. Chanda Samadhi. And the Virya Samadhi. I mean, to be able to sustain that, you do need the energy behind it. You know, the fuel to keep the car going. And you need that Chitta Samadhi, to be able to sustain the mind on that object. And Vimamsa Samadhi, because quite often one has to have this sustaining of that faculty of the mind which can investigate, to see from two different angles. Not investigating with thought or with reason, but just to be seeing things. Is this working? If not, let's try another way. The Vimamsa, the investigating mind, or the mind which isn't just blindly going for its goal, but the mind which has its goal, it's Chanda Samadhi, it's energized, it's sustaining the mind on the object, Chitta Samadhi, and it's got its eyes open, so to speak, so it knows whether it's attaining its aspiration, it knows whether it should try another little detour, or this way or that way. And this Vimamsa Samadhi is extremely important to be able to concentrate the mind. You may have many instructions, you may read the suttas, but it's the Vimamsa Samadhi which gives rise to the, for want of a better word, the street knowledge into jhana. Now, how your mind works, and what this advice means to you, what these words in Pali mean as your experience. And so this really helps the mind go on to its object. You know, it supports and fuels the vitaka and the vichara to keep nudging the mind onto the object and the vichara to hold it on there. And the stage comes with the meditation on the breath, when you have like good control over your meditation subject, so you can watch the breath from the very beginning to its end, from the very end to its beginning, again and again, time after time. And it's the sustaining of the attention on its object is what we mean by samadhi. Just the same way it's the sustaining of chanda which makes it an idipada. It is the sustaining of virya, it is the sustaining of citta, it's the sustaining of vimamsa which makes it an idipada. An ordinary person can just arise great amounts of will and great amounts of energy and great amounts of putting the mind on one object, great amounts of investigation, but they can't sustain it, they can't keep on going. That's why they don't attain to jhanas. That's why it is not a power which becomes effective. And so that idipadas maintain the vitaka and vichara until the vitaka and vichara become successful at this stage, then keep the attention firmly on the feeling of the breath. And once the feeling of the breath is maintained, so one is watching the breath from the very beginning to its end, from the very beginning to its end, always in the present moment, just as noticing this feeling just now, just now, just now, just now. It is that one-pointedness in the moment which is effective. I found it's a one-pointedness in the moment, much more than one-pointedness in any part of your body, which is very effective for the arising of jhanas. And in fact, that when I do the meditation, that I have no bodily awareness of where the breath is. It is just in one point in space and time. I just don't ask the body where it is. And once the breath does start to get calm to this particular stage, once the mind has got reasonable control over the meditation object, the hindrances are reasonably well suppressed. You have become secluded from the five hindrances at this particular stage, simply because the mind no longer is concerned with things outside. It's on its primary meditation object, on the feeling of the breath. If doubts still arise, if the mind is still restless and worried, if there's still laziness, if there's still ill will, if there's still concern, involvement with the five senses, you will not be able to get to this stage. The mind will keep being interrupted. But as soon as it's got the feeling of the breath completely, and it's got the whole body of the breath completely in mind, five hindrances are reasonably well suppressed. And at this stage that we start really getting the mental image of the breath, this is where the what we call the nimittas start to arise. And these nimittas which arise are indeed still the breath. They are part of the breath, an aspect of the breath. It is just the way that breath appears to the mind. It is the way the mind perceives the breath at this particular stage. And when the breath becomes very refined like this, the mind perceives it in, for a person who's not used to this, in very odd and strange ways. It may appear as a light, it may appear just as a pleasant feeling, it may appear as so many different sort of mental percepts according to the individual. But what is important here, it is the attention moves to what was once a physical feeling to what is now a mental perception. There's no way that one can get into a jhana on physical feeling. Jhana is the realm of the mind, and it is only through a mental percept that one can enter into a jhana. And without, sometimes if one is skilled and one knows what one is doing, one can avert to that mental nimitta. But for those of you who haven't got much experience in jhana, I would not advise adverting to the nimitta. What I would advise at this particular stage is just to remember that this type of meditation is called samatha, which means calming. And so when you have the breath fully in mind, just suggest to yourself, just calm, 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 calm. If you see any disturbance in the mind, calm it. Pacify the mind. And then naturally the mind's object will turn from what is the coarse physical feeling to the refined mental image. Be careful at this time that you don't allow doubt to arise. Is this the mental image or is this not the mental image? Calm, calm, calm. Keep calming the mind. Any of those thoughts which we call doubt, they're hindrances and they're going to hinder the mind entering jhana. So the mind should be wary enough of the hindrances at this stage. As soon as doubt arises, one suppresses it straight away and doesn't ask the question, is this a hindrance or is it not? So we doesn't encourage the hindrance by saying, is this a nimitta or is this not? One keeps the mind calming, calming, calming. And then that which one will see will become the mental object, will become the nimitta. This is a natural process of the mind which happens with all minds once we do this practice we call jhana meditation or samatha meditation. If you keep watching the breath from the very beginning to its end in this particular way and keep the mind sort of tending to calm, 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 the mental image will arise by itself. After a while you get to know that this is indeed a mental image. It will be different to every person in this room. The way that I look upon my mental image will not be the way that you will look upon yours. And that's why it does take a very skilled meditator to be able to teach others about nimittas and mental images. They are so personal. But you know, it is that which arises when the mind gets quiet enough that the physical feeling turns into the mental object. You will know another sign that is the mental image is that the mind is very peaceful. And it is a increase in the peace of the mind rather than a disturbance in the mind when the mental image comes up. And with that mental image will come the other important jhana factors of the Piti Sukha. And again, at this stage, my advice to you, and again this is not from the suttas, this is personal experience advice, do not at all be concerned which is Piti and which is Sukha. That will just giving rise to the hindrance of doubt again, and the mind will get restless and you'll lose it. From my experience at this particular stage, and even in the second jhana as well, Piti Sukha is indivisible. And you don't really know what is Piti and what is Sukha at this stage, and you can't know. The only time you really understand the difference between Piti and Sukha is when you've been in first jhana, and you've been in second jhana, and then you go into third. Because it's in third jhana where Piti falls away. And what you're left with is Sukha. And then you know what Sukha is then, because it's an experience. And these are like mental things. And they're just so difficult to put into words. An experience, sort of, you know, in like a deep jhana. But you know, this is what Sukha means. And when you know what Sukha means, when it's devoid of its like constant companion, usually Piti, then you also know what Piti is. But the Piti Sukha will be delightful feelings. So it'll be a delightful state of mind. And it is actually that delightful state of mind which one should not be afraid of, one should not be scared of, one should not be wary of. Because of all things, it is that Piti Sukha which actually draws the person into jhanas. It is like the magnet which draws the attention even further in. And it's the vitaka vichara, sort of, in a sense they've done their job once they get Piti Sukha strong enough for the mind to sort of be dragged in, willing or unwilling, into the mental object which becomes first jhana. That Piti Sukha is called Pariveka Sukha. It is it is dependent upon one being achieving seclusion from the world. And indeed one knows this because that state of even first jhana, the mind, as they say in Thai, you know, jit luam, the mind has come together. It is self-contained, if you like, for want of a better word. And it's just not at all interested in the outer world. In fact, the outer world has a hard time even contacting the mind at this stage. You've withdrawn, you're inside. They say that like a sound can disturb one in first jhana, and that's very true if it's a loud sound. If it's a soft sound, that, you know, most of the time you wouldn't notice it at all. It has to be someone really sort of banging a door loud, or shouting, or someone blasting a horn. Just a little bird outside just tweeting, or a person just walking slowly by you, you really wouldn't notice at all. Because the mind is in itself. And it's in itself and it's happy there. What's holding it there is the glue of Piti Sukha. And that becomes the main object of first jhana, of Piti Sukha, with vitaka and vichara. Which is that Piti Sukha is very strong, it is maintained. It is maintained still by the mind, vitaka and vichara in. The mind still moves back from that Piti Sukha and forward to it again, back and forward, very slightly. maybe you might describe it just like as the just like a light throbbing. Not really that still yet. Well, one only realizes it's not still once one has been into second jhana and knows what real stillness of the mind is, what real samadhi is. But at this particular stage, the mind automatically is still doing vitaka and vichara to keep its attention close by to piti sukha. It can't go too far away. But the point being here is that that piti sukha is sustained. The first jhana is not a state where piti sukha rises and then disappears again. It is a sustained state of consciousness which should last for a reasonable length of time. And again, the more powerful the experience is, the longer one will stay in it. If it's a very short experience, sometimes you can't be sure whether it's a jhana or not. When it's a long experience, half an hour, a couple of hours, that's when you emerge afterwards. You've got no doubt at all that was a jhana and a strong one. And it gives you the confidence afterwards to know that you have indeed attained a jhana. 5-minute jhanas are just, you know, really uncertain. And in my experience, most of the time they're not jhanas. And so one has the piti sukha, vitaka vichara, ekagata, the sustaining of the attention on its object. One pointedness on the piti sukha. That vitaka and vichara, the vitaka, the mind continually moving onto its object, the mind sees that as a hindrance. It's work. And what is work is a disturbance. And what is disturbance is what samatha is supposed to be eliminating. If that one understands from the very beginning this is a calming of the mind, a calming of all the sankharas, sort of a shutting down of activity, an abandoning of all busyness, then the mind will know that it's time to shut down vitaka and vichara. Now that Sariputta said that there is a jhana in which, like vitaka, is abandoned, and then vichara is still there. I was just thinking about this the other day, that some people call it the one and a half jhana, because they say when vitaka and vichara are completely abandoned, that that's supposed to be like second jhana. And indeed, like when vichara is still there, it's more close to second jhana than it is to first jhana. Because the mind is moving to that point. I mean, for vichara is like the mind having to hold the attention on the piti sukha. But when the mind is holding it on there and it doesn't leave at all, the mind automatically will just give up vichara. If you're holding something on there and you're successful, you don't hold anymore. And when the mind has piti sukha as its firm object, and the attention isn't moving away, then you do experience what one-pointedness means. And why one-pointedness, even in English, is such a beautiful, exact description of second jhana. The mind is just at one point. All the attention is together. There's just one object in the mind. And that one object in the mind is there moment after moment after moment after moment after moment. It's as if like Annie Chang has disappeared for a while and the world has stopped moving, the earth has stopped spinning, things have stopped coming and going. And it's just pure stillness in the mind. And a stillness not with somebody outside looking in, but the looking is right in the middle of what you're looking at. Complete one-pointedness. No object, no subject, just one oneness of mind. And that stillness, that strength, that power of the second jhana gives rise to this piti sukha, which is of a completely different order than the first jhana. And you realize that the piti sukha born of samadhi is so far superior than the piti sukha born of like renunciation of the five hindrances, the seclusion from the five sense world. That piti sukha of the second jhana is just so strong, and you feel you can sit in there for hours. Then really I can't see how anyone can get into second jhana and not sit for a long time. The deeper the jhana, I would say, the more time you would spend in there, because the quieter the mind is. There's less things in there to disturb and take you out. And if you know this, or the why on earth would anyone abandon piti sukha of second jhana, you know, sort of after 5 minutes? And what would cause that piti, what would be the cause of that samadhi breaking? I just don't really know. I can't imagine it. A second jhana should last for a long time. And a long time, like perfectly comfortable, without any intention or will to stay in a long time. This is a natural result, a natural part of the mind. When it gets absorbed to this degree, and it's enjoying itself so much, it just won't leave. And there's, in a second jhana, there's no way where you could formulate will. There's no way where you can, because will is verbal. And there's no possibility of any words. There's no thought at all can occur in second jhana. Nothing can be done, you're just stuck there. And you're quite happily stuck. And it is that solidity of mind, that one-pointedness, that firmness of mind, just being like a ball, only a ball with no diameter, just at a point, with no dimensions, always in the present moment, but without noticing the passage of time. You're one-pointed in space and one-pointed in time. So the whole universe, space and time, have disappeared for you. And you just blissed out in piti sukha. You're in like a mental perception here, and because mental perceptions have much more freedom than perceptions based on the physical realm, that you do get into like strange experiences. And this is one of those experiences, and it's a very peaceful, powerful, strong experience. And this is samadhi. This is the real first experience of samadhi in its fullness. That samadhi which is one-pointedness. Like I said, it's a piti sukha born of samadhi, which is the salient feature of the second jhana. And then if one has entered this with the aspiration, with the chanda, to calm things down even more, then the mind can quieten down, settle down even more, with dropping the piti and just having the sukha. Then it was quite strange for me for many years why they describe third jhana as, what is it, the state where the Aryans declare this is like a happy abiding. I said, why don't they describe like first jhana, that's pretty happy, or second jhana? Especially, I mean, why don't they describe fourth jhana? And it's because this is the last state where there's such a concept called happiness. Called like that delight in the mind. And it's amazing to sort of to know what delight is. You know, when it's you remove everything else and all that is left there is just delight, just by itself. And it's that, you know, in science, that's what one does to be able to know something, isolate it from everything else. So you know it as it is, rather than as a relationship between two things. And then you know just what sukha is, what delight is, what happiness is, what, you know, is the basic building block of the mind. And of course, that one stays in that a long time, because it is samadhi, it is one-pointedness. And the experience is that this is just all there is, just sukha, not changing, not wavering, not altering its size or its shape or its depth or its qualities at all, but just always there, always the same, moment after moment after moment, still in the timeless one-pointedness of mind. And if one is fortunate, that too will disappear, until there is just equanimity, just mind, neither happy nor unhappy. Just that which we call happiness, that concept, that perception has just completely been abandoned. One is a mind which just is. Just that one-pointed mental concept sustaining itself moment after moment for a long, 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 long time. And this is a mind which is refined, a mind which is still. It's just one concept maintaining itself. Quite often, like, a concept can't maintain itself very long in our mind. We think about it and it's just gone. And it is like that simile of just ringing a gong. If you've got a really big gong, one of these very fine ones from Japan, it might resonate for a long time, but you notice a change in the amplitude and maybe the pitch of the resonance with time. Imagine like a gong which, once you strike it, it carries on resonating, not changing at all, for 5 hours, 6 hours, and that's all you're aware of. You get some idea of what like a jhana is like. No change. Just the mind one, still, perfectly content, equanimity. And it's because that this particular type of jhana, the fourth jhana, is just one concept jhana, that it can be a springboard for the arupa jhanas, which are also one concept jhanas. But really, I don't really have too much experience of those, so I don't want to talk about those. But these are the ways into jhanas. And when the mind has had its time in the jhana, for causes which you have to set up before you enter the jhana, you cannot set them up within the jhana. Certainly that a resolution made before the jhana can have the power to keep you in there for that particular length of time. If not, it will depend upon, quite usually, like the energy with which you enter the jhana. Usually the strength of wirya and chanda with which you enter the jhana will keep you in there for a short time or a long time. And when you exit from a jhana, again, the telltale signs it's been a jhana is one, that the passage of time has not really been noticed. You sat a long time, you didn't really know. The piti sukha as you emerge from a jhana is extremely strong and remains a coarse form of piti sukha, but just, you know, usually you're blissed out, watery eyed. That lasts a long time. There is the clarity of the mind. The hindrances are still suppressed when you emerge from a jhana. They've just been smashed, knocked out, not cold. And it'll take them a long time to recover. The deeper the jhana, the longer you've stayed in that jhana, the longer the five hindrances will be smashed. They will come up again later on, but they're just out cold for many hours, sometimes many days. So one has that great clarity of the mind, and one knows what the Buddha said when he said the mind is malleable, workable, fit to be used. Once you know that the mind which has emerged
words from jhana, then you know why jhanas are really, really, really useful for the attainment of insight. Once you know what a mind which is workable is like, and you look at the other mind, which is, you know, the hindrances are there one moment, maybe they suppress them, but they pop up again. It's just, you know, hardly workable at all. You know, you might think you're investigating anicca, dukkha, anatta. You might think that you really want to sort of find out the meaning of these things. But no, really, once you've experienced a decent jhana and emerged from it afterwards and know what the workable mind means, then you know for yourself, as an experience, why the Buddha practiced jhana before he became enlightened, and why he encouraged other monks to practice jhana, to get that mind in a workable state. And that's one of the telltale signs that a jhana has been attained. But the mind is very, very workable. And practicing insight, if you just avert the mind to impermanence, impermanence, it just becomes such an easy thing to see. And you see it with such great depth. There's so much more than you've ever seen before outside of jhana experience. Dukkha, then you can see it, anatta. The mind is strong, it's workable. And if you want to remember past lives, you can just suggest to yourself, my earliest memory, take yourself back further and further and further. If you want to develop psychic powers with a workable mind, this is when one can. And then you can start to experience those things you read about in the suttas. And again, it gives so much joy and satta. You know, all these things the Buddha was talking about, they weren't just additions by later monks, they weren't just cultural additions, they weren't just, you know, just like Indian fantasies of gullible people. But these are actually true. You've experienced them, you know what they're like and how they're achieved. But of course it's the use of that mind to attain insight into anicca, dukkha, anatta. And as I've said here before, the anicca is the easiest on the surface, and therefore that it can trick you into thinking you know it. Dukkha is the next easiest, and maybe you might convince yourself you know dukkha. But again, you only know dukkha if you're fully enlightened, so please don't be fooled that you can see dukkha very easily. But it's anatta which is by far the most interesting, because most people know quite surely they don't really understand anatta, unless they can come up and say to another monk, you know, that I'm Sotapanna, knowing that if they're lying knowledgeably, they're parajika and they have to take their robes off. There's a real test if you're really certain or sure or not. Unless you're prepared to do that, then you're not Sotapanna. So it's because people are not, that anatta becomes a very, very powerful, useful thing to contemplate when one emerges from jhana. And again, as I've taught here before, the way to investigate anatta, which I recommend here, is what do I take myself to be? Who do I perceive myself to be? And who do I conceive myself to be? In the realm of perception and conception, the sannyas and the sankharas, what Ajahn Mahabur once said was the playground of the kilesas. What do I perceive myself to be? What do I conceive myself to be? And if you investigate with that tool, then that, in my experience and my advice is that you will have great success. So that this is my talk upon the way into jhana, what they feel like when one is inside of them. I'm sure that even though I've tried my best to be as accurate and as precise as possible, I'm sure that on this subject there will be many comments and also many questions. So I'm going to finish the talk now and invite any questions on the subject.
When doing an anapanasati, you could explain to me that as one keeps on watching the physical breath, this valid would feel the mental breath parallel, going on at the same time, and one takes takes a deliberate choice, the decision to switch, to drop the physical breath and to pay attention only to the mental breath. If there is a point where they go past their parallel, they go and they go together at the same time, and one can select.
That's very true. If one knows what the mental image is, that's what one does. But the problem is that if one hasn't really achieved a jhana yet, then one is unsure what the mental image really is. And that uncertainty will sometimes be a great hindrance into the attainment of jhanas. That's why I was suggesting that for those who have not experience of jhanas, especially those who have uncertainty about what the mental image really is, instead of selecting something, just keep on watching the breath, calming that breath, until the mental image appears by itself, so clear, so sure, you can't mistake it. As many of the questions I've been asked about jhanas have been concerned with, like, is this the mental image or not the mental image? This is what I'm experiencing. Should I watch this? Should I watch something else? And if one is experienced and one knows what the mental image is, of course that's what one does. And if one is even more experienced, then one doesn't even watch the breath. One just averts the mental image of a jhana. You bring that concept into the mind, and then one can just avert, bring up the concept, the nimitta, the mental nimitta of jhana. And if one is skilled, the mind will just go to that straight away, extremely pleasurable. And the mind will just go straight into a jhana. So really the question is answered by saying, it depends upon how well acquainted you are to the mental image, the nimitta. Does that make sense to you?
What you are saying is like one keep on watching the physical breath, and one as one keep on watching the physical breath, the mental breath will arise and replace the physical breath.
Yes, as long
as it's an automatic process.
It is an automatic process as long as you are calming the breath. As long as you're doing the fourth of the first tetrad of the Anapanasati Sutta. What is it? Kaya Pasambati. He calms the body of breath. Okay, yes, thank you.
The mental breath couldn't arrive on stage 1 to 3.
The mental breath can arise at any stage. It really depends upon one's acquaintance with that nimitta. I can, for those people who have done a lot of meditation and know jhanas, once you start, just the mind just woof 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 and goes up to the mental limiter straight away. So that mental limiter I just trick it off. And depending on how well you know it, you don't even need to even start watching the breath as it goes in and goes out. I'm going to just go and avert to that mental limiter, bring it up into the mind. So certainly it can arise even before the first stage. So certainly in the first, second, and the third of those tetrads can arise.
For beginning with the mental image, it arises progressively or just right like that?
It arises progressively, but the awareness of it might be sudden. Especially in the sense of if it is a visual nimitta, like a light, there is a stage where the mind just will move to that, away from the physical breath, by itself, and you'll notice that. And for many people, that not really knowing the limitations of the mind, they don't really know what to do with it. And so it disappears, and they go back to the physical breath, or they just alternate between the two. Neither of these were being strong. Sometimes the problem of reverting to that nimitta, that mental image, and then the mind hasn't got enough real peace, enough calmness, so the mental nimitta disappears, and so does the feeling of the breath, and the hindrances have just come up again, and you've lost both. So what I would suggest for those people who are not acquainted with the nimitta is even, like I've suggested this and I've practiced it myself, is even to suppress the mental nimitta and keep on the physical breath. I found this useful at times. If the mental image comes up too quickly, sometimes the mind isn't like stable enough, isn't peaceful enough to really be able to go and revert to that mental image and stay there long enough to enter a jhana. And so that, you know, I've actually, just through a very gentle effort of will, kept the mind on the physical feeling of the breath. I mentioned this to someone recently, and I just picked up a simile, just at the top of my head, that when I was a young boy, I don't know if they have it these days, had these little cars with gear wheels inside, and you'd move them backwards and forwards, trying to pick up the speed inside the gear wheels, and then you'd let it go and it would move across the room. And that's like similar to getting like the momentum of peace going. If you let the car go too soon, it won't go very far. But if you keep it going really strong and resist the mental image coming up and keep the mind very clearly and very firmly on the whole feeling of the breath from moment to moment. And then when you let that one go, when you revert to the mental image and it sticks and stays there. Does that make sense to you? I haven't seen that in any books or heard that before. That's just like experience. Yes, indeed. The being able to watch the whole breath body is all about continuity of attention. And quite often, if the breath disappears, it's not because it's replaced by the mental image, it's because that the hindrances have come up. And so one has to be careful there that one is maintaining. One is is building up the steps properly. One is building a house on a firm foundation rather than not building up too quickly. So to be able to keep that full awareness of the whole body of the breath from the beginning to its end without interruption, with no interruption at all. So you really know the breath. And again, what you know is you know that the breath is breathing. And then once the mental image is strong and you revert to that, then you know you don't. This is an important point. The mental image is still the breath. It is the mind perceiving the breath. It is an aspect of the breath. But it's looking in a completely different way. Again, this is for the tape, because many of you know this simile I've used before. it's like a person just watching an apple. And when you first look at an apple, you know, see its shape, its size, all sorts of other things about it, such as its stalk, the different, and all sorts of other things. And it's as if after a while, just its shape, its size, the stalk, most things disappear, and all you're left with is just the colour. And that's the only thing left, just colour. And it may seem strange to many people, how can you just see colour rather than the thing being coloured? This is just what the mind does. Another example I used was of Lewis Carroll's Cheshire Cat. You know, it's a brilliant simile of jhanas. I don't know where he got it from. He may have had jhana in a past life or something, I don't know. But like seeing a Cheshire Cat in the sky, and then according to this simile in, I think, Alice in Wonderland, or was it Alice with the Looking Glass? I think it was Alice with the Looking Glass. Until the Cheshire Cat in the sky, and it started to disappear bit by bit. Its tail disappeared, its paws disappeared, its ears disappeared, and then its head disappeared, until all that was left was the smile, without a head, without lips, without teeth. Then of course you think, I mean, it's impossible. How can you have a smile without something to be smiling? But this is what the mind is like. You have just like the mental nimitta of the breath without the physical feeling. You have like just peace without, you know, anything being peaceful. These are like, you know, disembodied. Nimittas are disembodied mental percepts. Yes, indeed. I mean, if that's like a way into the mental image.
If you know that it produces that, yeah, in the end.
For sure.
Reword
the question. As I understood the question, you were saying that as you watch the breathing, there becomes a physical sensation which becomes very strong. As you were saying this, you were pointing to the spot between the bottom of your nose and the upper lip. A physical feeling sort of becomes very strong there, much stronger than what you call the physical feeling of the breath. And then that gives rise to the mental image. And you were saying that is this a good idea to revert to that physical feeling, one-pointed in space between the bottom of your nose and upper lip, instead of just watching the whole breath? Indeed, I say yes. To explain the answer even more, that feeling at the tip of the nose is indeed the stage where you're watching the whole breath. You're watching the whole breath as if it's at one point, like, just like the simile of the saw, which I think is in the Patisambhida Magga, where like the saw is moving, but the carpenter is just watching the points on the wood where the saw is cutting it. And that's always said to be like similar to just watching the breath at the tip of the nose. And indeed, when I've said that I like disembody the feeling of the breath when I've been doing breath meditation, I just know whether it's going in or going out. And I've, as an experiment, you know, when I've been able to know the whole breath without any interruption, just from the very beginning to its end, end to beginning, I've just asked myself, just where is that breath positioned? Because unless I ask myself that, just my own experience, you know, I really don't know, because I've not really sort of even bothered with finding out or locating that breath in anywhere in my body. But whenever I've asked that, it's always been located between the bottom of my nose and my upper lip. It seems like quite naturally, whether you choose to watch it there or not, that's where it locates itself. So I don't actually watch the breath from the bottom of my nose. I just watch the breath as it goes in and goes out. And it settles down there by itself without my knowing it. That's it, yeah. That's it. That's right, yes. Once one knows what the nimitta is, then one goes to that as soon as possible. And that means that one starts to get like control power over samadhi and over jhanas. The tape is almost over now, so there's many questions, and they will not be on the rest of this tape. If one is interested in jhanas, then go and practice these things first of all. Once you practice everything which is on this tape, then you may ask questions.